Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Well, today you'll hear about the San Francisco Playhouse world premiere of Seared, which explores the delicately flavored balance between art and commerce in the world of haute cuisine in New York City. Lead actor Brian Dykstra is in the house. Plus details about the 17th annual extravaganza of terror and titillation known as Shocktoberfest at Thrill Peddlers. We'll hear from Russell Blackwood, one of the directors of the multi-performances that are going on. You'll also learn about The Natives Are Restless, a multimedia hula-centered presentation at the Palace of Fine Arts, from author Constance Hale. And about the Oakland Symphony's season-opening concert, Michael Morgan Music Director, which features baritone Hadley Adams. Stay with us. Well, actually, good afternoon. Thrill Peddlers presents Shocktoberfest 17, Pyramid of Freaks, their 17th annual extravaganza of terror and titillation, which includes five new one-act performances, including original music by Bay Area treasure Scrumbly Colduin, and music by Vagabondage, a folk punk band fronted by Thrill Peddlers stalwart John Flaw. It's at the Hypnodrome. Performances running now through the 19th of November. The Hypnodrome is on 10th Street between Bryant and Division Streets here in San Francisco. My guest is Russell Blackwood, director of Haunted House and the Hell Gramite Method. He's producing director of Thrill Peddlers as well, who adapted and produced and directed his first Grand Guignol horror play some 25 years ago, The Laboratory of Hallucinations. That led directly to founding Thrill Peddlers, and in 1999, the company produced the first annual Shocktoberfest, and 5 years later moved into the Hypnodrome, now their year-round home and Russell's full-time job. He won the TBA Award for Outstanding Direction for Pearls Over Shanghai. He's also directed for, among other local companies, Shotgun Players, Theater Rhinoceros, Berkeley Opera, Pocket Opera, The Lamplighters, and for the San Francisco, L.A., and Lake Tahoe Shakespeare Festivals. His productions have been seen around the country and around the world, and it's a pleasure to welcome Russell to talk about this year's Shocktoberfest. Hey, Russell.
Thanks for having me here, David.
Well, gosh, Shocktoberfest 17. Do tell us about what's going to be happening at the Hypnodrome.
Well, its subtitle this year is Pyramid of Freaks. We always choose one of the plays to be the title play of the bill. As an attention grabber, but this is indeed our 17th year of our Grand Guignol Terror Theater Extravaganza. And it also marks our 25th anniversary of having produced our first Grand Guignol play and the re-release of Mel Gordon's Grand Guignol book, the first in the English language, and that's the one that started it all for me back in 1988. It's now out in the third edition, and Mel has dedicated it to me.
Oh, well, congratulations. Very nice. Well, let's get people on the same page for what Grand Guignol is.
It began in the late 1890s as an experiment in naturalism, and quickly the theater found that these hyper-realistic short plays that were supposed to look like real life had the best success with audiences when they ended in bloodletting. So very quickly, the Grand Guignol developed a genre that was about terror and about over-the-top bloodletting and gore. Now, because naturalist plays were relatively short and one needed a palate cleanser after a some of these dramas. They would intersperse them with sex farces and comedies. And what they developed was something called the douche écossais, the Scottish shower. The hot showers being the sex farces and comedies, the cold showers being the terror plays and dramas. So it's this roller coaster of 5, 6, 7 plays on a bill in one evening.
And so you're close to that. You've got 5 different productions going on in this Shocktoberfest.
Yes, and this year we also have some musical elements as well. Not only do we have a full one act by Cockette Scrumbly Caldwin, but also we're working with Vagabondage, this band that you mentioned on the lead-in, who also do some of their material on the bill. They have a fiddle, accordion, stand-up bass, and guitar, so it's a full musical complement.
And you're directing, I believe, one of the shows, many shows within the show, The Hell Grammite Method, which is an adaptation of a Twilight Zone episode.
It is indeed. It came out in 1988, the same year that Mel Gordon's Grand Guignol book wound up in my lap and this all started. Bill Selby, who's been our longtime poster designer and playwright for us, wrote this episode for the new Twilight Zone in 88 and has since reimagined it, setting it in San Francisco in the 19-teens, and we've excised the narration that would make it seem like a Twilight Zone episode, but I think there are still hallmarks of it, of the genre there.
You're entering a world of science.
Exactly right. Then the other piece
I'm
directing.
A modern mortality tale, probing the horrors of parasitic dipsomania.
The other play that I'm directing is from 1903, and that's actually from Le Théâtre de Grand Guignol, which first coined this theatrical genre. And it's a play that starts out as what you feel is the classic haunted house tale and quickly unravels to, something quite shocking.
Well, I take it that's the terror, not the titillation part of things. Or maybe I'm wrong.
You know, sex and death have a tendency to intermingle in the Grand Guignol. So there's a little of both. And then the only other play on the bill, I would mention Demon Train to Sodom, Scrumbly Caldwin's piece, Pyramid of Freaks, the title piece by Rob Keefe, which is kind of a cross between Diane Arbus, Todd Browning's Freaks, and Tom and Jerry episode.
Well, it's quite a cast of characters. You got people playing multiple roles in different elements.
It's a cast of 19, David.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, and then the whole company is on board for our Blackout Spook Show finale.
And so tell us what we're going to see in the, well, you know, within reason, what we're going to see in the finale.
Spook shows came
Scottish
about in
shower,
the 1930s in America when music halls were closing up shop and magicians were finding it hard to find employment. So some magicians got the idea that they would do a spooky-themed magic show at movie theaters at midnight, re-release some of the classic horror movies, and the finale of these 40-minute spooky magic shows would mean pulling the plug on the electricity in the entire theater, aisle lights, the projector, exit signs, everything, and phosphorus ghosts would fly overhead, things would brush up against your face, and you never really knew whether it was the stagehands and the magicians that were causing all of the terror or if it was the person sitting behind you. Great place to bring a date, as you can well imagine, the Spook Show.
Wow. So this is, it looks like a fun for all. Now, is it necessarily a PG-13 production? Should we need to caution people?
It is intended for adults. While I would say that somebody younger would be fine seeing the first half of the bill, the second half of the bill is definitely for grown-ups.
All right. And you've been involved with this from the very beginning.
Sure enough.
And keeping it fresh every year, it must be both fun and challenging.
Well, I have to say that what a Shocktoberfest might be is changing all the time as shock value seems to become more and more important to the entertainment industry and as the word terror gets
bandied about all too often.
Exactly right.
So tell me a little bit more about Scrumbly's participation this year and the original movie. We're going to hear in just shortly Checkered Past. What is that? This is from Demon Train to Sodom?
It is indeed. It's one of John Flaw's songs from Vagabondage. The role was written especially for him. Scrumbly and Thrill Peddlers have been working together for the past 11 years, and it all started with a New York production that we were commissioned to do of Pearls Over Shanghai, one of the shows had written for the Cockettes. That was such a big success in New York that we mounted a production of it here, and it ran for 22 months, David. And, of course, that was enough for Scrumbly and I to really get going. We revived five different Cockettes shows, some of them with a lot of new music that hadn't been in the originals. And for the third year now, he's writing purely original musicals just for Thrill Peddlers.
And Thrill Peddlers is really fortunate to have such a great venue in the Hypnodrome. It's just perfectly sized.
I'm telling you, it's a purpose-built horror theater. We have a life-size guillotine, and one of the options for seating is something we call the shock boxes, which are modeled after a seating option in Parisian theaters called the loge grillée. These are private box seats that you can bring a grillwork front up in front of so that you can see the show, but the show can't see you. Parisian trysting booths, I guess, is what you might think of. And we do have a curtain that you can pull across, and we can't see in.
Well, you know, titillation is part of the press release.
So they're also individually themed.
Self-titillation might be
involved. We have the Pharaoh's Tomb, Heaven and Hell, the Asylum of Shock, individual themes in each of these. So it's kind of, you know, the Madonna Inn meets William Castle films, because they're also rigged for the spook show with some special effects.
That's Russell Blackwood. He's the producing director of Thrill Peddlers Shocktoberfest 17, which will include five, count them, five new one-act performances: The Haunted House, a classic Grand Guignol thriller; The Helgramite Method, which is an adaptation of a new Twilight Zone version for the stage now; Demon Train to Sodom, which we'll hear shortly, an excerpt from Pyramid of Freaks; and a Lights Out Spook Show finale. Fantastic. Thanks so much for talking with us, Russell.
Thank you.
Information at hypnodrome.org. Performances are running well into November until the 19th. Let's hear now some music of Scrumbly Coldoon and Checkered Past from Demon Train to Sodom.
I used to serve all of humanity. I sacrificed my pride and vanity. One night I got an offer that I couldn't refuse. I felt the power surging down to my shoes. Yeah, I'm the checkered demon with a slightly checkered past. I do what I damn well want, and baby, that is a gas. I ride around a hellish battlefield, pick off a soldier, then I make him yield. Then I carve out his eyeballs just to make me laugh, saying I'm the checkered demon, here's my autograph. Yeah, I'm the checkered demon with a slightly checkered past. Yeah, I do what I damn well want, and baby, that is a gas. Sometimes I come through the reverend, sometimes through a big tycoon, sometimes I come through a politician, sometimes the cook at a greasy spoon.
Music of Scrumbly Coldoon is part of Shocktoberfest 17, hypnodrome.org. For more information for those performances, which run through November 19th. Good afternoon once again. I'm David LaTulipe. You're listening to Open Air on Local Public Radio, KALW. You'll also hear today about the San Francisco Playhouse world premiere of Seared, which explores haute cuisine in New York City, and the question of commerce versus artistry in making food. I'll be talking with Michael Morgan as well, who is the music director of the Oakland Symphony, about their opening concert, which features baritone Hadley Adams. That's still to come here on Local Public Radio, KALW. ¶¶ My next guest, best-selling author Constance Hale, takes a fresh look at the world of hula with the release of The Natives Are Restless, a San Francisco dance master, takes hula into the 21st century. This first-of-its-kind book explores the largely untold story of Hawaiian hula, using the groundbreaking choreography and teachings of San Francisco dance master Patrick Makuakane. The book release coincides with the return of Nale Hula to the San Francisco's Palace of Fine Arts Theater with its iconic show, also titled The Natives Are Restless, featuring some of the original groundbreaking numbers as well as some 15 new choreographed pieces and live music provided by the award-winning Hawaiian music duo Kupau. The show presents an epic tale of Hawaiian resilience and draws upon many of the same themes as the book. Constance Hale is a Hawaii-born, San Francisco-based journalist who has been covering Hawaiian culture for more than 25 years. Her award-winning features on slack key guitar, the sovereignty movement, the Hawaiian language, Big Island Cowboys, and Spam Sushi have appeared in The Atlantic, National Geographic Adventure, Afar, Smithsonian, LA Times, Miami Herald, and the magazine Honolulu. She's also worked as a staff reporter and editor at the Oakland Trib and the San Francisco Examiner, as well as Wired and Health magazine. Hale started dancing the hula at 7, switching to ballet and jazz dance while at the Punahou School and Princeton University, and she's also studied hula with Patrick Makuakane for some 20 years. Constance, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Well, we started with the very well-known Hawaiian war chant, which is something that you debunk quite a bit, and you it feels necessary to prove that there's not necessarily authenticity involved there.
That's probably one of the most recognizable quote-unquote Hawaiian songs, but it's not Hawaiian, and it's not really a song, and we didn't really have a war chant. It was something that was invented in the Hapahauli or half-white era of Hawaiian music. And I love it that you started with it because it is a dance and song that Patrick Makuakane uses to really turn the stereotypes that we all have of hula on their heads. So that song is a stereotype of Hawaiian music. Most people, when I mention that I've written a book on hula, the first words out of their mouth are, oh yeah, the hula hoop, which has nothing to do with hula. If they are a little more sophisticated, they might sort of flop their hands on each side and say, oh yeah, hula. So it just both,
grass skirts always.
And we have no grass skirts in Hawaii. It's a complete, all of those stereotypes that people bring to hula are false.
Really?
So this was a huge reason to write the book, was to write about what I consider to be an incredibly rich, albeit esoteric, but authentic ethnic dance tradition, which is part of the United States, even though it's completely separate from popular American culture.
So being raised in, or born and raised in Hawaii, did you experience more of the stereotypical touristy stuff, or did you start right in with the authenticity?
Well, it's interesting. I was born and raised in Hawaii, but I was born out in the country, and I grew up in a little town on the north shore of Oahu. So in my case, it was a very large and somewhat intact Hawaiian community in my town. We had a May Day festival every year at school that couldn't have been more authentic in the dances that we were taught. At the same time, that was the 1960s and the 1970s, and Waikiki was awash with the more stereotypic kind of hula, which you might see if you were a tourist at a hotel or if you went to a schlocky luau and they taught you the hukilau, which is a wonderful song, but it's also one of those kind of stereotypic Hawaiian hulas that don't begin to suggest the variety and texture of hula.
Yes, the performances at the Palace of Fine Arts is coinciding, as I mentioned, with the release of your book, which is being called a coffee table book. So it sounds like a significant volume.
Yes, well, we call it an intellectual coffee table book. I wanted to write a narrative book about hula and Hawaiian culture, but it would be impossible to write about Kumu Patrick Makuakane and his work without pictures, because it's so visual, it's so visceral, and it hits the audience members with so many different sensory experiences that we decided to make it a coffee table book.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about your first association with Patrick.
You know, I was a reporter, a freelance reporter, cultural reporter, and there was a big performance of Hawaiian music that was coming to the Bay Area. It was kind of the first big performance of this kind of Hawaiian music that I had ever seen. Patrick Mukuakane was dancing, so I interviewed him. I met him as a journalist because he was performing at the show, and then I think I interviewed him one more time, and probably 6 months later I decided, you know, despite my age and my previous devotion to modern music, modern dance, I wanted to study hula, and an older Hawaiian friend of mine said, if you're going to do hula, you have to study with Patrick.
And were you associated with the first performances? This is kind of a redo of this of his show, The Natives Are Restless.
I wasn't. So I was taking classes at the time, and I saw the performance. I actually did not see the 1996 performance, which was in San Francisco. I think I first saw Natives in Hawaii in 1998. So it was inaugurated in 1996 and then performed about 20 times after that. And I wrote about it in a magazine article. I was studying with Patrick at the time, and I just started. So I watched it very closely. And when Kumu Patrick told me that he was going to reimagine that show, which in some ways is his seminal show, it was the first time that he used hula to tell an epic, and in this case, very political story. When he told me that he was going to redo it for its 20th anniversary and update it and add a second act, which would bring the theme, which was the collision between Native Hawaiian culture and Western culture, he was going to bring that into the 20th and indeed the 21st century, I thought that's really interesting. That's the subject of a book.
And the not only the dance production, but your book explores all kinds of aspects of Hawaiian culture, from sovereignty to occupation. So let's talk about some of the things that are people don't really know that much about in terms of the history of Hawaii.
It's so true. I mean, in some ways, you could say a pivot point in Hawaiian history. I mean, it's hard to say a pivot point because, of course, Hawaiian history started millennia, you know, a very long time ago, and was rich and interesting before Westerners ever came to Hawaii. And then missionaries came and merchants came, and Hawaiian culture changed a lot throughout the 19th century. But the Hawaiian kingdom was an independent kingdom recognized by the first non-European country to be embraced by the family of nations. It had treaties with countries all over the world. And yet, despite that, despite its independence, in 1893, Queen Liliuokalani was overthrown. And after several years of tumult, in 1898, Hawaii was, quote-unquote, annexed by the United States. However, the annexation was never actually done according to treaties or laws the way it should have been done. So Native Hawaiians today are preferring to call the whole century since then an occupation because and there's some lawyers and political scientists who are looking at the way that transfer of power happened and bringing it actually to the International Court in The Hague. Meanwhile, Hawaiian culture diminished in the 20th century as the American culture became more and more predominant. And by the time I was a kid in the 60s, it was nobody spoke Hawaiian. It was a dying language. Very few people were engaged in Hawaiian culture in a full-blooded way. And that all changed in the 70s and 80s with a cultural renaissance and then movements for some sort of political, we call it the sovereignty movement, but Native Hawaiians argued that they ought to have the same right to self-determination that other Native American peoples had. And now we come to today, where Native Hawaiian activism is taking a new turn. And I see Patrick Mukuakane as part of this new movement of Native Hawaiians saying, the past was the past. You know, we have some ideas about our culture and about our politics, and they are expressing them and finding entirely new ways of doing that, like a hula opera or an epic Hawaiian show like The Natives Are Restless, which tells a lot of this history through dance and music.
Nice. And your book not only explores the sovereignty issue, but the whole statehood process and how that happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and well, interestingly, you know, before statehood, there were two plebiscites, I guess you could say, that are significant. In the late 19th century, 95% of Native Hawaiians signed petitions opposing the annexation. That is a fact that's forgotten a lot by history. In 1959, the Hawaiian population had changed so much. The demographics were completely different. People weren't subjects of an independent kingdom anymore. And Hawaii, the population of Hawaii voted to become a state. And many, many, I would say probably the majority of people in Hawaii still want to be a state of the United States. So it's by no means is there a certain future.
Let's talk about more about the show then. Mm-hmm. As we continue, this is coinciding with your book release. The performances will be just through the 23rd, four performances only at the Palace of Fine Arts.
I should just add, there's one performance called Hula, we call it Hula for Families, on the 23rd during the daytime. So there are actually five performances.
Great. That's at 3 p.m. on the 23rd for Hula for Families. So what will, for those that missed the first time around, the natives are restless, kind of indicates that it's not just going to be a fun show. There's some education going on there.
Yeah, it's a heavy show in a lot of segments, and it's unsettling in some segments, and then there are a couple of segments that are just sort of uproariously funny and fun. So there's a mix, but...
You mentioned turning the hula, the war chant on its head, right?
Mm-hmm. And in this case, my favorite funny dance in this particular one is called Wobble, and it really takes... It starts from... by trying to talk about the incredible resurgence of Hawaiian design and people who are doing fashion and just this really kind of fun sensibility that's very contemporary, very hip-hop, and that's a funny, lighthearted dance to leaven what some other dances, which are pretty heavy, violent in some cases. But there's also, I think a lot of times when people think of hula, they think of loveliness or graciousness or pretty girls with flowers in their hair. A lot of hula is fierce. A lot of hula is warrior-like. A lot of hula is historical. It has the poetry maybe praising ancient warriors, but then what Patrick McQuilkane does so in such an interesting way is to talk about, okay, here's this chant praising ancient or patriots from 100 years ago. Who are the patriots today? And so he might take that chant and use it, change the music a bit, and use it to talk about patriots today in Hawaii who are telling a story very much like the story of the Standing Rock Sioux in North Dakota. That is getting a lot of national media. The story in Hawaii isn't getting as much national media, but we have a situation right now where one of the most sacred mountains in Hawaii, Mauna Kea, our biggest volcano, has been the site of really interesting protests because some pretty major universities are trying to build the largest telescope in the world on the summit of the mountain. And Native Hawaiians are rising up and saying, hang on, that's our mountain. And so there have been a lot of protests about the mountain. And at least at this point, the Native Hawaiians have won. The permit to build the telescope was rescinded, and the environmental impact study process is starting all over again. So it was a rare and pretty interesting victory for Native Hawaiians. And that song, when there's a dance in the show, Kamā Makakaua, the original music refers to the Patriots of 1898, but the song explicitly is talking about the Patriots of today. So that gives you a sense of how he's bridging history and contemporary times, contemporary issues.
That's Connie Hale, author of The Natives Are Restless, a San Francisco dance master, takes hula into the 21st century. And that dance master is Patrick Makuakane, with performances through the 23rd, five performances at the Palace of Fine Arts. Connie, as a author, a native born Hawaiian, and a scholar, where do you see things going with the various nativist movements?
Well, who knows? What's interesting to me is that in my lifetime, and I should just say I am born in Hawaii, but I'm of European heritage. I don't usually call myself Hawaiian because I'm not native Hawaiian by blood. And yet I love the culture, was raised with the culture. And over my lifetime, I've seen it took 30 years for native Hawaiians to gain back from the United States the island of Kaho'olawe, one of the eight major islands. It was owned by the federal government because it was taken from the Queen in 1898. And there were 30 years of amazing protests in Congress, on canoes, throughout. And it finally was given back to the Native Hawaiians. That's what made the protest about Mauna Kea so significant. It took about 2 years. And there was this major victory. So I think that there's this, I think, watching this, that there's a sense of new power among Native Hawaiians. It may not be that they persist with the sovereignty movement per se, but there's a sense that they know history better. They speak the language again. They can read. You know, we're just in a different moment. When you have tens of thousands of people who can read Hawaiian, where 30 years ago no one could read Hawaiian, they can go back and read newspapers from the 1800s.
Mm.
They can understand the poetry in a different way. And there are other Native Hawaiians who have become lawyers and politicians. So the moment is different now. There's much more power residing with Native Hawaiians. Where they'll take it, I can't say, but I'll be there to watch it.
Nice, nice. Constance Hale, author of The Natives Are Restless, a San Francisco dance master, takes hula into the 21st century. This volume of your work can be found, I'm assuming, at your local bookstores?
Yes.
Excellent. And the performances of Nailehulu, The Natives Are Restless, run through the 23rd at the Palace of Fine Arts. Tickets are available at cityboxoffice.com. Connie, thanks for coming in today, and we look forward to catching the performances at the Palace of Fine Arts.
Mahalo.
One thing I'd like you to mention, though, is you mentioned that Patrick is turning some of the traditional music on its head that we're hearing now. Just an excerpt from...
This is the song that I was mentioning earlier, Kama Makakaua, which is written by Palani Vaughn, a contemporary songwriter, in praise of patriots from the 19th century, and it's being used, it's being reimagined. This is a mix that Patrick McCulloch-Connie himself put together, and it's being used to praise the patriots of Hawaii today.
As part of The Natives Are Restless at the Palace of Fine Arts. Hawaiian music reimagined by Patrick Makuakane in his performances of The Native Are Restless through the 23rd at the Palace of Fine Arts. Tickets at cityboxoffice.com. Well, a different take on food is being presented by the San Francisco Playhouse as they begin their 14th season with the tasty world premiere Seared by powerhouse playwright Teresa Rebeck. Seared is a special commission by the San Francisco Playhouse from a playwright whose works have been produced in New York, across the country, and on television. Seared explores the delicate balance between a creative spirit navigating success, recognition, and responsibility to a financial bottom line, and stars Brian Dykstra as the
has Harry, the chef of the moment in the New York City restaurant scene. Brian is an actor and playwright in his own right. He last appeared at the Playhouse as Rooster Byron in Jerusalem. Fantastic performance of that, by the way. In the past year, he's appeared in two other Teresa Riebeck world premiere plays, The Nest at Denver Center and her adaptation of The Way of the World at the Dorset Theater Festival, which was directed by the playwright, along with two Riebeck films, Poor Behavior and Trouble, both written and directed by Teresa. He performed on Broadway in Lucky Guy, and other recent credits include LBJ in All the Way, Mark Rothko in Red, and Lord Capulet in Romeo and Juliet. Brian, it's a pleasure to welcome you to KALW and to talk about Seared.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Well, the role of Harry was created with you specifically in mind. So congrats on a wonderful performance and a terrific not only looking but smelling production,
yeah.
I should mention. So my brief bio intro didn't quite give a full synopsis of the play, so could you perhaps enlighten our audience about the full storyline of Seared?
Well, it's art versus commerce sort of character study. The restaurant is run by the two of us, Mike and I, and I'm the creative and he's the money guy. And the creative's going well, but the money is not. So there needs to be a nod to a little bit of financial consideration that Harry doesn't want to participate in. So
Enter the consultant,
and we're off and running. I mean, it's the plot is interesting and fun, but not the, we had a talk back and somebody asked about it being a character study, and one of the other actors said, no, it actually does have all the elements of a well-made play. It's this battle of wills where nobody's wrong, but everybody's wrong.
Interesting. And it's a classic struggle, especially with and timely for here in the Bay Area as well. It could be easily transferred from New York City to San Francisco with a small, struggling restaurant being faced with an inevitable rent increase. And so what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, this is part of Teresa's play is her experience in Hollywood. So you're trying to, or more specifically, television. So when you're trying to do something that's artistic, the entire world is pressuring you to make commercial take commercial considerations. So what do? I think you run back to the theater.
Yeah. So personal experience as a chef, or at least a cook in your own home?
Yeah, I do. I cook at least, say, 6.5 times a week. I mean, in New York City, I live in New York. There's that culture of going out. There's the culture of ordering in. But I enjoy cooking.
Well, you have to have the space, first of all, to have at least a modest kitchen in New York. And that's always a challenge.
That is true, although we lucked into an apartment 18 years ago, and it's fine.
good.
Yeah, it works out. Uh-huh.
So tell me how you've a long track history with Teresa Riebeck. When did that first start?
Well, I met her in grad school. I went to Brandeis. She was a third-year playwright. I was a first-year actor. There was a play that she wrote called To Spite His Face about a man who gets his nose cut off. She wanted to cast me in one of the roles. I didn't get the part because of whatever reason. And I was leaving Brandeis because I didn't like the training. But I left her, I don't think we ever spoke, but I left her a fan letter in her mailbox on my way out. And about 6 or 7 years later, I was at a party with a classmate. She walked in. We saw each other again, and she said, I know you. And I said, well, sure, you leave someone their first fan letter, you're not going to forget them. So that was the beginning.
And this role was written with you in mind.
Yeah, the commission was for the San Francisco Playhouse. The San Francisco Playhouse commissioned the play with the caveat that they'd be apart from me after I'd done Jerusalem here. They knew I knew Teresa. The other caveat was that Margaret Perry would direct it, who Teresa knows well as well. And so she started writing a play about Russian diplomats and translators who fall in love. And she got to about page 8 for about 6 weeks or longer, and her husband said, you never finish the plays that you stop after 6 weeks. What do you want to see Brian do? And we had cooked together, the husband and I, at his house, their country house. They have a country house in Vermont. And we cooked a number of times. and Teresa was enjoying the fruits of that labor. And she said, I want to see him cook. And then after that, she wrote the play very, very quickly. It came sort of gushing out of her.
Have you worked with director Margaret Perry before?
Many, many times, yeah.
What does she bring to the production?
Margaret is a truth slave. Is that the right word?
Okay.
You know, you don't get away with anything with Margaret. She's going to do the play. It's not going to be high concept stuff, which is hard to which is necessary with new plays, but not always the case. There are some new play directors who will set a new play on the moon or in a space station, and you at the end of it you learn, well, the production either works or doesn't work, but you don't know if the play works or doesn't work. Margaret will do the new play straight ahead, and if you try to do something to get a laugh that's not quite human or make some sort of choice that begins to stray out of the realm of not believability but away from what's truthful psychologically, then she will pull you back. Also, her understanding of tone is something that you don't run into very often with most directors. I mean, what does a director need? A director needs great taste and an understanding of tone and an understanding of human psychology. And so she possesses all three of those qualities.
We must give a shout-out to your fellow actors, especially Larry Powell, who plays the restaurant server. Some wonderful subtleties to his performance.
Yeah, Larry's a dream. We worked with him. He actually did a play reading of mine in Vermont that Teresa came to see. And I think she knew his work a little bit, but after the play reading of this play of mine, she said, can we get him for the San Francisco production? So that's kind of how that fell into place.
Fantastic. And Rod Knapp is playing Mike.
Yeah, he's such a fun guy to act with. I mean, I didn't know Rod before this at all. You show up, and these two characters are like, they love each other. They're old, old friends, and it's the weird thing about theater. You show up at the first rehearsal and like, oh, we've been friends for 15 years and we know each other really well. Go. And he's been easy to like, easy to love, and you just, you know, the relationship that needs depth, you've got to find it in each other quickly.
You mentioned that Mike is the money guy, you're the artiste chef involved, and it does come down to, you know, Mike wanting to make his nut back,
yeah,
so to speak, and trying to move things forward with you thinking what's wrong with things are going the way things are going now.
His argument is absolutely reasonable. And sometimes you run into an artist that doesn't want to worry about living in that, worry about those sort of human considerations.
Part of the spark for moving forward is not only the engaging of a consultant to see where things can make a little bit more money, but the impetus was for everything was a listing in New York Magazine?
Yeah, New York Magazine.
New York Magazine that sparked an interest in a signature dish, which you, as the chef, subsequently refused to make anymore.
That's correct. I'm not making the scallops.
I believe there are scallops involved.
Yeah, I mean, there's that artist thing where you get famous for something, and so they want you to mass produce the silk screens. Or, you know, after a while, I think you get tired of making soup cans, even though everybody wants the soup cans. So Harry doesn't...
Good analogy, by the way.
Thanks. Well, it's food. Harry doesn't want to be pigeonholed. He wants to keep creating. And most... I can't remember who, but Teresa referenced this, I think, New Zealander who pointed out, and let me get this quote right, something about how Americans love individual thinking and expression, and as soon as they identify it, they mass produce it as much as they possibly can. So we're a culture that loves the individual thinker, and then we copy it to death until another one comes along.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned that it's a terrific smelling production. Now, I don't know if there is an official title for olfactory director in the credits.
I don't think there's an olfactory director. I mean, the script says when the audience walks in, there's the smell of garlic and onions and olive oil. So, and then when you're actually cooking, you're going to get smells.
I was going to ask, you're actually cooking aren't you?
I have cuts and burns to prove it.
So what's it like? Are you refining your cooking technique? Is this run, or is it a matter of rote doing the same the same movements over and over again.
I didn't think I liked salmon, but cooking it every night, I was like, oh, there's a way to cook salmon that I actually do like it.
I'll have to talk after this.
Well, I mean, hot and fast, like restaurants often do. When I went to Farallon to trail a sous chef, and actually the executive chef, or maybe not the executive chef, but the chef,
mm-hmm.
and they took a piece of fish and they put it skin side down in the hottest pan I've seen people cook with, and he used his fingers to press the skin down so that it would not buckle, and it got crispy, and then they finish it in the oven at like 475, and it was stunning in no time at all. So you're like, okay. I mean, you know that hot and fast is best, but you don't think you should get the olive oil to the point of smoking, and yet that's what they did. So that's what we find ourselves doing. I hear it becomes carcinogenic at some point, but you know,
what doesn't? What doesn't?
Yeah. It's delicious. So what the hell? Yeah.
So did you learn a little bit that you're taking back to your home kitchen? And
sure. Yeah. Nice. I mean, I didn't think I liked fish until about 5 or 6 years ago, but what I learned was I don't like not fresh fish, which makes a perfect amount of sense. So.
Well, the run is through November 12th at the San Francisco Playhouse. It's the world premiere of a new play by Teresa Rebeck Seared, commissioned by the San Francisco Playhouse, directed by Mark Perry, and featuring Brian as the lead chef, Harry. I also needed to shout out some kudos to your sound designer, Theodore Hulsker, who really makes you feel that you're participating in the whole process. It's
good
amazing.
Catch. That sound design is stunning.
And using not only the sounds of the kitchen, but actually incorporating them into actual musical production numbers, so to speak.
Yeah, there's a lot of percussion that's pots and pans and containers being hit with serving spoons, and yeah, it's delicious.
Well, terrific run to you. I hope you don't gain too much from the salmon. And
it's the donut.
It's the donut.
Oh,
it's
man,
right.
They make me a donut. And you're like, oh, really? Every show? Thanks.
That donut scene is integral to Seared as well. Information at sfplayhouse.com. .com, I think. Yes? Is it .com?
I remember.
.org. They're a .org, yes, okay. Of course. It's sfplayhouse.org. Thanks for coming in, Brian.
Sure, my pleasure.
Catch Seared at the San Francisco Playhouse, a really fun production. Again, fun smelling as well as a fun on all the way around, learning a little bit about some kitchen technique myself last night's performance, sfplayhouse.org. Well, from good smelling and good tasting production, I don't know if those apply to my next guest, Michael Morgan, the director of the Oakland Symphony. They opened their 2016-17 season with the return of charismatic baritone Hadley Adams singing Mahler's Rückertlieder, and the debut of Delphi Trio performing Paul Juon's Episodes Concertante. The concert is Friday, October 14th at 8 p.m. at the Paramount Theater in Oakland. And the program opens with Clark Supranowicz's Red States, Blue States from 2008 in recognition of the elections this November, concluding with Elgar's in the South. Michael Morgan, music director of the Oakland Symphony, joins me by phone. Michael, hello.
Good. Hello. How are you?
Hey, sorry for the interruption of wavelength confusion the other day. You were going to be joining me in studio, but I think with some construction happening around here, we kind of missed our cues.
Yeah, I couldn't find you, yes.
Oh, well, now we have you by phone, at least, to talk about your program. A very interesting combination of things going on in this opening concert.
Yes, actually, apart from the new piece, the Red States, Blue States, the other three pieces, the Juon, the Mahler, and the Elgar, are all sort of three faces of romanticism. It's a very romantic concert. I realize people don't know the Juon, but it's the Russian early 20th century romanticism. Will remind you of Rachmaninoff, etc.
And working with New Zealand-born baritone Hadley Adams, who has received a lot of international acclaim for his performances, not only on stage but in concert. He was a Adler Fellow. Before that, he was a Marilla Opera Program grad.
Yes, we accidentally found him last year because we needed a baritone for, we had a cancellation, needed a baritone for our Candide, and several people I spoke to said, you have to hear him, you have to talk to him. And that's how we first met him, and he made such a huge impression that we asked him to come back and do something on opening night.
Terrific guy, and a sweetheart of a man, too. We worked with him with the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony as well.
Yes, and he the Mahler songs, it's as though they were written for him. He's incredible in them.
The Elgar, well, let's talk about the Red States, Blue States piece first off. Very timely, of course, intentionally.
Yes, of course, but actually, the thing about it, you would think that a piece called Red States, Blue States would be about conflict, but actually it's about dialogue, and so it's actually, for the most part, a rather gentle piece. It's more about the Red States and Blue States getting along rather than arguing with each other. What? So it's almost an orchestra scherzo, and has a middle section which the composer says is sort of depiction of political speeches and people making pronouncements during the campaign. But yeah, it's a much more peaceful piece than we would think of when we think Red States, Blue States these days.
Well, let's hope that spirit of cooperation continues after November 9th. We'll see, between the Reds and the Blues.
Absolutely.
In the South by Edward Elgar, a work that I'm not familiar with that we're going to hear shortly, at least an excerpt of. We're not talking about the South of this country.
No, you're talking about Southern Europe. You're talking about Alassio, which is a city on the Italian Riviera, where Elgar took a vacation. And the piece is really, I call it the English Don Juan, because it really reminds you very much of the brilliance and the sort of thrilling orchestration, like the Strauss tone poem Don Juan. It's always been a favorite piece of mine, and I'm surprised how many people have just never ever heard it, except anyone English knows it backwards and forwards.
Well, we'll hear it, at least give people a taste of it shortly. OaklandSymphony.org, always interesting programming, Michael. Also, tell me a little bit more about Paul Juon's Episodes Concertants.
That is a very large piece for piano trio, for the Delphi Trio. And we think this is the West Coast premiere, but it's actually an older piece. And as I say, very, very romantic. The second movement, which is my favorite, particularly reminds you of, it evokes Sibelius and Wagner and romantics of that era. And then the outside movements are very Russian and suggesting the romanticism of the very late 19th and very early 20th century. So it's actually quite a beautiful romantic piece that the Delphi actually brought to me. I did not know it, and they wanted to do it, and I was happy to say yes.
Very nice. As I mentioned, always interesting program from the Oakland Symphony. Congratulations on the start of this new season, Michael.
Thank you.
OaklandSymphony.org for more information, and we'll talk in person next time when we get our channels uncrossed. How's that?
We absolutely will.
All right, Michael.
Look forward to it.
Cheers. As I mentioned, let's hear a little bit of the not-so-well-known In the South, Alassio, Opus 50, of Edward Elgar, to be featured as part of the Oakland Symphony's opening concert on the 14th of October, Friday, October 14th, at the Paramount Theater in Oakland. Music of Elgar. Just a taste of In the South, the music of Edward Elgar, which will be concluding the Oakland Symphony's concert on Friday, October 14th, this Friday at 8 at the Paramount Theater in Oakland. Information at oaklandsymphony.org, featuring baritone Hadley Adams as well. Well, another event happening Friday at 7:30 down south a little bit on the peninsula in the Los Altos Hills. Good friend and flutist Robert Stallman is doing a house concert of an all-Mozart soiree, including new arrangements for flute and piano. Robert is one of the leading flutists of our time, and you can find some information by sending an email to Judy Quinn. Judy Quinn, with two N's, 123 at gmail.com, to catch Robert Stallman down on the peninsula. Well, it's another birthday celebratory day for Paul Simon, turning 75 this very day. The great Paul Simon, happy birthday to you, Paul, as we go out with one of your iconic numbers.
A man walks down the street. He says, why am I soft in the middle now? Why am I soft in the middle? The rest of my life is so hard. I need a photo opportunity. I want a shot of redemption. Don't want to end up a cartoon in a cartoon graveyard. Bone digger, bone digger, dogs in the moonlight. Far away, my well-lit door. Mr. Beer melon, get these mutts away from me, you know. I don't find this stuff amusing anymore. If you be my bodyguard, I can be your lawn. Call you Betty, Betty, when you call me, you can call me out. A man walks down the street, he says, why am I short of attention? Got a short little span of attention, and oh, my nights are so long. Where's my wife and family? What if I die here? Who'll be my role model now that my role model is gone, gone? He ducked back down the alley with some roly-poly little bat-faced girl. All along, along, there were incidents and accidents. There were hints and allegations. If you'll be my bodyguard, I can be your long-lost pal. I can call you Betty, and Betty, when you call me, you can call me out. Call me out.
Happy birthday, 75 years of still creative energy, Paul Simon's birthday today. That's Open Air for this Thursday, October 13th. My thanks to producer Niels Swinkels for herding cats and arranging our guests. If you've got a segment suggestion, send me an email, david@kalw.org. A reminder that our shows are archived at our website, kalw.org. Look for the Open Air tab. Thanks also to Peter Robinson, who stood in for me a couple weeks back. Didn't get a chance to thank him properly. Thank you, Peter, who is now off to England himself. Stay tuned for an hour of news from the BBC, recorded an hour earlier for broadcast at this time on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.
Maybe it's the third world. Maybe it's his first time around. Doesn't speak language. He holds no currency. He is a foreign man. Surrounded by the sound, cattle in the marketplace, scatterings and orphanages.